Hey everybody, it's Mike. Welcome or welcome back to the Revision Church Podcast. While you're here, make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and download the Revision app, which is actually the best way to get access to new content and share it with friends. You can get the app by texting Revision app to 77977. Thanks for listening today. My hope is that this message will be helpful for you and would inspire you to take the next step on your faith journey. Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Mike. I'm one of the pastors at Revision. I'm excited to be here today. How about you? All right. Well, we did it. We got chosen on Wednesday, 55 kids in a tiny, poor little village called Sierra Linca, which is about 100 miles west of Tegucigalpa, Honduras, chose their sponsor. Let's clap for that. That's awesome. It's so cool. Here's some pictures of them choosing us. It's exciting. These are kids who don't get to choose anything. They don't get to choose what they wear because they only have one set of clothes. They don't get to choose what they eat or even whether or not they get to eat on a certain day. And this week, they were able to choose us. Their village chose our church. We chose to be sponsors, and they chose us, which is so cool. I'm just fired up about the opportunity we have to enter into this journey of relationship and love that transcends physical distance and socioeconomic distance and linguistic and cultural distance. It is awesome. And at the end of the service this morning, I'm going to talk to those of you who signed up last Sunday, because there's an envelope with your name on it out there that has a picture of the child that chose you. And sometime this week, you're going to get a letter from them in your email. But today, after you open that envelope and see who chose you, you'll have an opportunity to go to the cafeteria and write a letter to them as we just step into this journey with kids in Sierra Linca. And if you're here thinking, what in the world is going on? Like, I missed 1 week and now this. I want to be chosen. I want to help sponsor a kid and rewrite the story for someone growing up in poverty in Sierra Linca, or you're a guest here for the first time. Like, if God's tugging at your heart to be a part of this at the end of today, I'm going to give you some instructions about how you can sign up to do that too, because we are hosting a second round chosen party in Sierra Linca. So that's what's up. It's really, really exciting. And today we're in the middle of this series called Chosen. That's kind of what I want to talk about this morning, because I think there's something powerful about having somebody pick you. Deep down inside every single one of us, in our souls, there's this longing to be considered good enough, valuable enough, worthy enough to be chosen. But there's a vulnerability in that that also means, like, it's powerful to be rejected as well. And both of those experiences, being chosen or being rejected, tend to leave a pretty significant mark on us. They tend to shape our self-image, what we see when we look in the mirror. Whenever either one of them happens to us, like, it leaves a lasting mark and memory. Like, so we live in fear of the one and longing for the other, but we can remember the times we experienced either. Let's just have an honest, like, audience participation moment. Everybody raise your hands. How many of you can remember an experience of being dumped? Somebody looked at you and they're like, I want to spend my life with someone and start a family. I just don't want that someone to be you, right? And you're like, oh yeah, totally. That's actually what I was hoping you were going to say to me today. Or how many of you have ever interviewed for a job or a scholarship you really wanted and then you didn't get it? Tried out for a team and you didn't make it. That happened to Michael Jordan too. You're not losers. It's okay. But we really feel like losers when we get rejected, don't we? It's easy to get into this headspace of like, oh man, I am not good enough. And sometimes even when we get chosen, we have an internal dialogue that is so toxic that we think, I bet that person is really sorry they chose me. A while back, I was in Haiti with a bunch of college students, and we went to this little town we were staying in. We went into the village to play soccer with the kids, and the full-time missionary who was there named Jen came with us. And as they were picking soccer teams, I got picked before Jen did, and I'm sure it had nothing to do with the fact that she's a girl. But fast forward about 5 minutes, turns out Jen played college soccer. She was a beast, and the kid who picked me for his team crossed me the ball right in front of the goal. I shanked it off the side of my foot, stumbled a little, and stepped in a huge fresh cow pie. I got all in my shoe. I was wearing Nike shocks. It was all the way in there. And I couldn't help but think, I bet that kid is sorry that he picked me instead of Jen. I stink, metaphorically and in this moment, literally. I just stink. And it's so easy, I think, that I get into that headspace. I stink. I'm not pretty enough, smart enough, successful enough, good enough. I'm just not enough. And we live in the middle of this world that constantly reinforces that idea that we're failures and we're flawed and we're unworthy and we're never going to make it and we're useless and we're unimportant. And if we believe that, then we end up living into it. I think the truth is we rarely live beyond our own self-perception. We rarely enter into a story that's more epic and beautiful than what we believe about who we really are. And if we start to believe that we are not enough, then we get caught up in this frantic race everybody's running to get to the top, to prove to ourselves and everybody around us that we should be loved and we are valuable and we are worthy. But what if we didn't have to run that frantic race anymore? What if we didn't have to spend one more minute of our lives worrying about being rejected and wondering whether we're worthy and whether we're valuable? I think in order to do that, we'd have to be convinced that somebody who determines value says we are valuable. Somebody with the authority to decide whether or not we're important says that we are important. We'd have to believe that and build our identity upon it. If you got a Bible or a Bible with you this morning, you can crack it open to the book of 1 Peter chapter 2. It's way towards the back, sandwiched between James and 2 Peter. If you don't have a Bible, no worries. The words are going to be up on the screen, or you can follow along in the Revision app. And if you need a Bible, please take one from the Next Steps table before you go today. They're free, and we love it when they disappear. But 1 Peter 2, Peter kicks it off by talking about this race that we're all into the top to prove that we're worthy, about the crushing weight of all the anxiety we live with, about all the pain and hurt and frustration and suffering that are a reality for every human who exists in this shattered, sin-stained space. And then in verse 9, he says this, and I want everybody out here to read the first two words with me. They're in bold. You ready? But you... Time out. That's a huge but, you guys. Everybody say that with me. Say, that's a huge but. That's a huge but. I asked my 9-year-old daughter, is it appropriate to have everyone say that in church? And she said, well, Daddy, it depends on how many T's you use. So just one T, but it is a huge but. Because what Peter's trying to help us understand is like there's this reality that exists for all human beings, a reality of frustration and suffering and pain and wondering constantly whether we're going to be rejected, but not you. No, not you. You have been selected as worthy. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, God's special possession, a holy nation, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you're the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. And Peter's begging us to understand here, this is who you are. And if you believe that, if you latch on to this identity, that you are a chosen people, that God decided to pick you, it changes absolutely everything about who you are and how you live and move and breathe in the world. You just got to understand what it means. And this morning, what I want to do is just dig in to what it means, because I desperately want all of us to walk out of here today and experience the transformation that comes from knowing deep in our souls that the creator of the universe believes that we're so valuable, we're worth giving up everything for. Because that's what he says about you and me. Peter kicks this thing off by saying we're a chosen people. And the Greek phrase there is elekton genos. Elekton means picked because it's the best, picked because it's great, selected because it's worthy. And genos means race, like a distinct people group. So when Peter says you are an elekton genos, he says you are a distinct race of people. And what he's trying to help us understand here is that once that happens, once you join that race of people, something shifts inside of you. And it's fascinating that he writes this, because he's writing to the first truly multicultural gathering of people that ever existed in the history of the world. Like never, ever, ever before this thing that exploded called the church This group of Jesus followers that gathered and called themselves the Ecclesia, the called out ones, had any organization gathered people across socioeconomic barriers and racial barriers and color barriers and gender barriers and invited everybody in. But then the church exploded onto the scene during this period of history known as the Pax Romana. What happened was the Roman Empire conquered so many different peoples that all the tribes weren't warring anymore. Rome was just in charge of everybody. And so they eventually moved closer and closer together, and cities became kind of multicultural. And then this weird group of people started inviting everybody in. They started saying, I don't care who you are, I don't care where you've been, I don't care where you come from, I don't care what you've done, you're welcome to belong here. All you gotta do is believe that God chose you. Believe that he stepped out of eternity into history to give his life so you could be forgiven and free. And if you'll accept that, you can be a part of this thing. And what Peter's trying to get us to understand in this verse is that once you're a part of that thing, you get this new identity, and that identity trumps every other identity you have. This new thing is bigger, better, and more transcendent than all of the stuff that divided you before. Because it connects you across all those lines. And look, we live in this world that's full of division, that constantly tugs at every single one of us to define ourselves over and against other people. Like I'm part of this tribe or that tribe because of what I believe, because of the policies I advocate for, because of the place that I was born, because of the characteristics I have. And what Peter wants us to know here is that it matters in the middle of all that, that we remember who God says we are first and foremost and above everything else. Because from the very start, Jesus set about creating this community that was radically different, that turned the tribalism we see all around us, the kind of tribalism that inspires hate and rejection and in-crowds and out-crowds, completely upside down. One of my favorite stories about how he does this comes in John 4, and this is like a whole sermon, and you'll get the whole sermon sometime because this stuff fires me up. But in John 4, John writes this line that almost feels like a throwaway line. Like if we didn't know what he was doing, it'd be like, oh, why did he even include that detail in the story? But in verse 1, he says, now Jesus learned the Pharisees had heard he was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John the Baptist. So he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. Like we read that, and we think, why did he leave Judea and go back to Galilee? And our lens is that the Pharisees were the enemies of Jesus and they wanted him dead. But that's totally not what's happening here. By the time that John 4 rolls around, he had had no interactions with them whatsoever. They weren't antagonistic. They just didn't know each other. And then the Pharisees heard that he was this popular teacher, and so they sought him out. But as soon as Jesus learned he was on the Pharisees' radar, he ducked out. Why? Well, here's what's going down. At this moment in Israel's history, they'd been conquered by Rome, and there were four major political parties. They had the Sadducees, who are these guys who thought like, hey, if we just get along with Rome, everything's gonna be fine. And they paid Rome for influence. And they just basically adapted to Roman culture and Roman society. And so their political platform was follow. We're just gonna follow along with Rome and everything will be fine. And then you have this other party called the Essenes. And they were so worried about the poison influences of Roman culture that they said, we gotta separate ourselves completely. We got to get out of here. And so they left and they went out to the wilderness and they formed their own little communities and they kept out anybody who wasn't just like them. And so their political platform was flee, hold the world, the big, bad, scary world at an arm's length. They had a group called the Zealots. And the Zealots believed that the only way forward for Israel was armed rebellion against the oppressive pagan regime that conquered them. And so they stockpiled weapons, they engaged in terroristic activities, and they plotted a military overthrow of Rome. Their political platform was fight. Then you have this fourth group, the Pharisees. And they're like, you know what? Our problem isn't our freedom as much as it is our faith. The functional question we need to be asking as a society isn't whether or not we're following Rome, it's whether or not we're following God. Are we obeying him? Their political platform was faith. Faith is the central question of our lives. Now, audience participation moment. Somebody shout out the answer to me. Follow Rome, like follow, flee, fight, or faith. Which one of those sounds like Jesus? Faith. The Pharisees. They sound exactly like Jesus, which is why Jesus hit out from him, because as soon as they found out about him, they're fist pumping. They're like, yes, this guy, he's popular. People like him. He's on our side. He's teaching the stuff that we're teaching. And so they wanted him to join. And Jesus went in the other direction because he identified himself with no tribe. He refused to put himself in one group over and against all of the other groups. And so they're looking at him. They're like, oh, Jesus is for sure a Pharisee. Jesus is for sure a Republican. Jesus is for sure a Democrat. And Jesus is like, nah, I'm doing something bigger. It's not that stuff doesn't matter. It's just I got a whole different mission that matters on a grander cosmic scale. I'm inviting you to a community that transcends all of the other communities, all of the other identities, all of the other tribes that you could belong to that divided you before. And even in his little group of 12 disciples, Jesus was able to see that, realize he had people from all four of those parties. He had Matthew, a tax collector. This guy worked for the Roman government. He blended in like nobody's business. And then he had this ragtag group of guys from the country, some of whom were just trying to hide out and do their own thing and fish and stay off of Rome's radar, and others of whom were like, I think the Pharisees are right. Faith is a really big deal. And then he had a dude named Simon the Zealot. That was his nickname. Up until the day he met Jesus, he was plotting armed rebellion against Rome. And then Jesus came up. He's like, Simon, are you planning on swording a Roman soldier today? And Simon's like, what? No. This is Carl's sword. I don't know. And somehow Jesus brought these dudes together in this tight-knit group of friends. How? Jesus is how. It's what he does. He chose them to be his people. And being his chosen people, his electon genos, was an identity that was bigger than all those other identities. Like, we live in a world that can't fathom how that's even possible. But we know how it's possible. We know how Jesus connects us to this greater community that matters more and that trumps all our other identities. It happens because none of us deserved it. None of us were born into it. None of us merited being chosen. Not one of us was good enough to earn our way in. It just happened. God loved us enough and he invited us in. And that's the whole beauty of it. God chooses us not because of our greatness, but in spite of our brokenness. God chooses us not because of our greatness, but in spite of our brokenness. And the cool thing is that being chosen is so transformative. That even though we got chosen in spite of our fears and our flaws and our faults and our failures, it changes something in us and allows us to live lives of greatness. I said it before, I'll say it again. There is something powerful about being chosen. I still remember a time growing up when my brother and I went out into our street to play basketball with some neighborhood kids. And we were picking teams that day, and James was like the youngest and shortest kid out there, probably a healthy margin. But I was the team captain and I picked him first. Not because of his skill, but in spite of it. Our neighbor was in college. He was like 2 feet taller than my brother. I just wanted my brother on my team. And because he got chosen first, he might not even remember this, but something in him leveled up that day. He could not miss a shot. He was on fire. Like being chosen shifted something in his mind. And it was so fun and so cool to see. And that happened even though I picked him, despite the fact that he didn't have the best skills on the court. And if he wasn't sitting in here and didn't go to this church, I would just let that story hang and leave all of you to walk away believing I'm an amazing brother. Like, oh, what a killer big brother. I wish I had a big brother like Mike. But the truth is, I only picked him. I didn't like any of the other kids as people. So it was kind of a James, I guess, situation. But even though that's the case, it still leveled him up. You're welcome. So that's the thing. But that's what being chosen by God does for us. Because he picked me. He picked you, and then he invites us in, not just to belonging, but to meaning and purpose. He welcomes us into this family that allows us to be way more than just the sum of our parts, as he takes all of the broken pieces of our lives and builds them together into something beautiful, something that shapes the narrative and creates the future, a better one for the world around us than the one it's headed toward right now. And that's the beauty of this. Peter actually talks about this in 1 Peter chapter 2. He says, like, when God chose us, we decided to let him do it, we decided to put our faith in him, then we were born into his family. Like, this is like new birth that occurs, this new life that explodes inside of our souls. I don't know if you guys have ever seen birth before. I've seen a few. They're miraculous and incredible and profoundly gross. But either way, birth creates family. It does. Every time a human is born, they're born into a family. Now, there are good families and bad families. There are big families and small families. There are functional families and dysfunctional families, families that want you and families that reject you. But no human has ever been born into just the nothingness of an individual existence. We're born into community somehow, some way, and that's what God invites us to family, to community, to connection, to relationship. Peter writes this, as you come to him, the living stone, which is a weird name, but he's quoting Isaiah here. He says, as you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans, but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood. It's fair to admit, Peter's given us kind of an awkward mixed metaphor. He says, okay, when you come to God, you're his children and his priests and also rocks. That's an awkward combination. To be fair, my children are like rocks if you put a screen in front of them. They sit there and don't move and don't hear a word that you say. But that's not what Peter's trying to say. He's trying to speak again to our identity. He's saying, look, you're invited to be a part of this thing, this community, this connection that allows you to experience relationship with the divine like no one else has ever experienced it before. The church was so new, you guys. We don't even realize how radical it is because we exist in the church era. But not only was it this community that invited everybody in from all walks of life and all spaces and all races, it was a place that functioned differently than every other religious experience in the history of the world. Because they said, look, we don't need a sacrificial ritual anymore. And we don't need a priest anymore. And we don't even need a building anymore. See, every culture and every religion in the world had said this. There's a gap that exists between you and God. And you need a holy man, and it was always a man, performing a holy ritual in a holy place in order to bridge that gap. And the Christians came along and they're like, no, you don't. Jesus bridged the gap when he died on the cross, so we don't need some space that was like built by laying brick upon brick upon brick anymore, that's so holy we can experience the divine there. That's just not how it works. And it was shocking. People were like, you don't need a temple? There's no temple in this religion? And they're like, no, there is a place that you can go to experience the presence of God. There's a place that you can be to crash into his presence and feel his spirit move. It's just not a place that's found by layering brick upon brick. It's a place that's found by layering Christian upon Christian, by gathering his chosen people together in community. That's the place where you can meet the love of God. That's the place where you can find strength to face every battle. Like, when we embrace this identity of being chosen, we connect to the people of God, we're strong. We can stand against anything this messed up world throws our way because people built together are stronger than bricks built together. And that may sound like a ridiculous thing to say, but it's true. In the 5th century BC, as the Persians were conquering most of the known world, they sent a messenger to the legendary city of Sparta to offer terms of peace. And when the messenger showed up, he was shocked to find no walls around the city. Like, every ancient city had walls. That's how you protected your people. And almost condescendingly and full of pride, this messenger asked the Spartan king, Agesilaus, where are Sparta's walls? And famously, Agesilaus looked at him And then he looked over at some soldiers, trained from the age of 7 in the Agagae into the Spartan warrior cult. And he pointed and said, "These are Sparta's walls." The legendary Spartan lawgiver Lycurgus had written, "A city is well fortified which has walls of men instead of brick." And the Spartans lived as though that were true. And it was absolutely crazy to the Persians. But for centuries, they conquered city after city after city by breaking down walls, even the massive walled city of Athens. But not one Persian warrior ever so much as set a sandal inside of Sparta. People built together are stronger than bricks built together. That's why God gives us the gift of each other. We are part of this community of His. It's not a place that we have to go to. It's who we are everywhere we go. Every place we gather and every space we inhabit throughout the week, we are the thing in the world that is intended to point hurting and broken people toward His love. That's why Peter says you're not just a chosen people, you're a royal priesthood. Which sounds like a cool thing, but what in the world does it mean to be a royal priesthood? Well, it's actually an intentional oxymoron. It didn't exist, royal priests. In the ancient Near Eastern world to which Peter is writing, you could be a king or you could be a priest. You could be a queen or you could be a priestess. But you couldn't be both. Because royals ruled and priests served, and people with the power to rule certainly don't serve. It didn't happen. That's not how it works until this dude named Jesus came along. He said, "Yeah, I actually created this whole thing. I'm ruling over all of it, but I also came to serve. That's how I like to do it. That's how it's done in my kingdom." And then he invited us to live as princes and princesses, to experience the beauty and the riches and the wealth of a royal inheritance, but to chase it, not like the kings and queens of earth, by trying to get to the top and put everyone else beneath us, but instead by trying to get up under the problems of the people around us. So that's what true royalty looks like. It looks like priesthood. It looks like service. It looks like helping point people toward the love of Jesus. That actually works beautifully with the building metaphor, because buildings are at their strongest when you put the biggest, strongest stones at the bottom. Not when they're at the top crushing everything beneath them, but when they're underneath supporting and lifting up the smaller, weaker stones. And that's what the church does. That's what we do here. This is what it means to be the people of God. Not that we're fighting to get to the top, clamoring to prove to the world that we are successful enough and worthy enough and great enough and valuable, but instead fighting to get up underneath the problems of the people around us. That's how we build the church. That's how we do it here. We put the strongest people at the bottom, serving everybody all over the place and lifting them up. It's who we are. It's who you are. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a living, breathing, moving around temple that points the world to the glory of Jesus and invites them to be chosen too. You're a holy nation, a tribe set apart for love, hope, joy, peace, purpose, and meaning, and an identity in Jesus that transcends every other identity you have. You are God's special possession. In Greek, that's just one word. It's peripoiesis. It's a word that the Greeks used to describe somebody's most treasured possession, like the one thing that they owned that they considered more valuable than everything else. Listen, you are the thing the creator of the world finds most valuable in this world. And all I want you to do today, my only invitation, is walk out believing that. Would you just believe it deep in your soul? Because you know, and I know, and we all know, the insecurities are going to come. Probably soon. They're going to hit you, and they're going to hit me, and those voices are going to begin to whisper into our minds again, "You are not enough." And if we listen to that, we're going to walk around believing that we are less than what God says we are, that we are less than chosen, holy, and dearly loved. And we're going to live into lives that are less than the lives that we were created for. And my hope this morning, my prayer, is that amidst all those other voices that tell you that you're failed and tell you that you'll never be enough, God's voice would thunder louder in your soul. And then instead of getting caught up in this frantic race to the top to prove to everybody how valuable you are, you would rest in the knowledge that the creator of the universe gave everything to have you in his family because that's how much he values you. That's who you are. I love the way the author Henry Nouwen says it. He says, we are not what we do or what people say about us, and we are not what we have. We are the beloved sons and daughters of God. And you guys, I think when we live like that's true, when we love each other like that's true, it just points the world around us toward God's love. It changes everything. And that's part of what excites me so much about this World Vision partnership we've entered into with Chosen. It allows us to get up under the problem of poverty in another part of the world. It allows us to layer our lives together with these people in Sierra Leone, these kids and these moms and these dads and these families who are struggling, and allows us to get up under their problems and weave our lives and our stories together with them across physical boundaries and linguistic boundaries and cultural boundaries and socioeconomic boundaries in a way that creates space for us to better reflect the love of Jesus to the world around us and them to better reflect the love of Jesus to the world around them. It makes everybody better. And the band's going to come up and play, and I'm going to hop up at the end of the service. And if you sponsored a kid last Sunday, I'm going to tell you how you can figure out who your sponsor is and write them a letter. And if you didn't, you're like, man, God's talking to my heart. I would like to do that. I want to be a part of that. I'll tell you how you can do that. But before we enter into a time of worship again, I just want to say this to everybody in here. Whether you participate in the child sponsorship thing or not, because this is for all of us and it changes everything about every one of us every single day. Here it is. Believe this. God chose you. You are the thing that he treasures most in this world, no matter who you are, where you've been, or what you've done. You are loved. You are valuable. You are enough. You are chosen. Will you pray with me? God, thank you. Thank you for reaching into the brokenness of our stories, for choosing us, for giving everything to have us in your family, despite all of our fears and our faults and our flaws and our failures and every other thing that makes us unworthy. Thank you for deciding that we're worthy. Thank you for valuing us enough that you came and gave your life so we could be forgiven and set free and live forever as a part of your family. God, I pray today that in a world of division, we would be a people of unity. We'd be a people that love each other and love the world around us in a way that just absolutely points them toward your love. And I pray today for every person in this room as we walk out into a world that will constantly tell us that we are not valuable and that we're failures and that we're not enough and that we'll never be enough, that you would thunder in our souls and remind us who you say we are. That all of us would walk out of here today knowing that we are chosen, holy, and dearly loved. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.